SpotlightOnPodcast.com/store is the place to go to get a Spotlight On collectible for the music and arts lover in your life, or maybe even yourself. Go to SpotlightOnPodcast.com/store today. Hello and welcome to Spotlight On, a production of 23 Media Ventures. I'm your host, Lawrence Purrier. Today, the spotlight shines on musician and songwriter Nicholas Dembling, a.k.a. Nick North, a.k.a. Nick West, of seminal New York City new wave pop band, Comateens. The New York that birthed Comateens was in the midst of a particularly vibrant musical moment. There was new music everywhere. Jazz cats were holding loft concerts in pre-glitz Soho. The punks and the no wavers were holding court on the Lower East Side. Philip Glass and the Minimalists were premiering new works, and way up in the Bronx, hip-hop was coming on strong. Nick was working at New York's Media Sound Recording Studio, where he and co-worker Ramona Lee Jan began to write songs together. With necessity as the mother of invention, Nick and Ramona began to play gigs with only a bass, a guitar, and an electronic rhythm box, so that the band and its equipment could fit into one New York City taxicab. This self-imposed constraint led to the original Comateens, a concept shared by Alan Vega and Martin Rev, who were doing something similar with their lineup in their duo Suicide. Nick takes us through both his and Comateens' musical upbringing and development, as well as how he is documenting and preserving the band's legacy. Thank you so much for making time to talk today.
Pleasure.
Really excited for this. In doing my prep work and reading about Comateens and the various incarnations over the years, obviously it's a fascinating time just in New York and music and the arts.
That's for sure.
And I used to always perceive it as different worlds, right? There was the downtown CB scene. There was what Philip Glass was doing. There was whatever was going on in the jazz world. And I've really come to understand through various readings over the last year or two that there was much more cross-pollination and overlap than I think the previous histories really indicated.
True. I think one thing we were not was punk. And that seems to be the sobriquet applied across the board to everyone working in those days and in those places. But really, punk was a very narrow thing, and we were not it. We were not punk.
What were you at the time? Because I think history's called you something else, but what were you at the time?
I don't want to delve too deeply in what history might have called us. I think we would be termed new wave, maybe. I don't know. We were a little bit younger than a lot of the groups doing CBGBs and Maxes and all those places. So we were kind of at the tail end, you know, Talking Heads and all those bands were older than us. We were one of the first groups on the scene to use electronic drums, for example. It was us, there was Suicide, and across the pond, there was Kraftwerk. So we were known as a kind of an electropop band. Our sound was unique, really.
Talk to me a little bit about pre-Comateens, Nick, in terms of what music world did you come out of, or what did you grow up listening to? Because it's not immediately obvious. Like, I hear some of the almost like 60s pop references.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But I'm curious as to what was in your head at that point.
I was born in London, England, and then I was raised in Manhattan. And my parents loved folk music, so there was always a lot of folk music on the box. My parents were the first people I ever knew who owned a Bob Dylan record, for example. And then I had classical piano, and then a janitor in a building was a jazz drummer, and he taught me some jazz drumming kind of stuff. I had a million things going on. I think that my first thing was classical music, and then when the Beatles hit, that whole thing changed for me. I thought, that's a good job. I'll do that. And I was obsessed with that from then on, and I still am, as a matter of fact. So I wanted to write pop hooks. That was my big thing. I'm into Gershwin. I'm into TV jingles. I'm into TV show theme songs. I want to write stuff that people can't get out of their head. And that has been my entire musical drive, my entire musical life. I'm sorry that Ramona Jan is not with us, because Ramona Jan will tell you that she has no influences whatsoever. Her thing was to express herself only, and she listened to nothing. But I'm the one that listened to a billion things, James Brown, you name it. I loved it all. And it all goes into what I do.
It's really fascinating to hear, because I've read some of the other interviews that the two of you have been doing over the last few months around this reissue. That point comes up repeatedly, that she was a bit of a blank slate in terms of musical influences. And
which is something I never realized about her until these interviews. I didn't know that. I thought, oh, well, she's a musician. She must have listened to a million things. Nothing. And she was an engineer in a major recording studio as well. She was not impressed.
Let me come back to that in just one moment, because there was something you said in your previous response that I just wanted to call out, which is you mentioned TV jingles.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, and apropos of nothing, I woke up this morning with the theme from The Odd Couple stuck in my head. I've been walking around all morning.
One of the greatest TV shows ever in history.
And incredible theme song. Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness. That is one of the greatest theme songs. Yeah.
It's funny how those things work. The point about Ramona and what you did and didn't know is also interesting, because it feels like that came up also a lot in the interviews with the two of you, that, and it was just so surprising to see multiple times, like, she didn't know it was your first time singing. You didn't necessarily know how serious and ambitious she was thinking about Comateens. Like, how did you have so much unspoken between you?
We were working in this same place in this recording studio, and we decided to do this band as a kind of a hobby, everyone else was doing a band. It was the late 70s. I had already been in multiple bands. I was in a blues band. I was in a kind of a jazz band. And we just thought we would do it as a lark. And we started in a tiny little room in Ramona's apartment with a bass guitar and a guitar and a rhythm box. I had no idea that she was aiming for a music career. I thought we were just fooling around. But it went further than that. But still, she didn't express that to me. I'd had plenty of experience. I'd already played in the New York clubs, and she was learning certain things from me. I was learning a lot from her, because she was a primitive in many ways. And I thought that was great. I just loved starting from ground zero with no influences and no preconceived notions of what we should be doing. I really liked that. Mm. It took this project 40 years for me to understand a lot about her.
It shed a lot of light on potential explanations as to how you stopped working together, right? Like, if one person has more, I don't want to say seriousness, but has a different sense of what the outcome should be than the other, that right there that's built in tension.
It's built in tension. No, that was not a tension between us at all. The reason we stopped working together is because my brother was having a lot of problems, and I wanted to bring him into the band as our guitar player, to give him a focus, to give him something to do. Mm. And since I didn't think that we were doing it seriously as a career, I thought, okay, we're just going to do that. I could have done it better. David Byrne is out there now telling everyone that he handled the breakup of the Talking Heads very badly. And now he's trying to fix it with the other guys. But we were young. We were in our early 20s. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll have my brother in the band now. That'll give him something to do. And that's what happened. That's why we stopped working together.
It's something to see in the dynamic between the two of you, just how I struggle for the right adjective, but there seems to be so much admiration and respect for each other. A lot, you just speak very warmly towards each other and very almost openly or vulnerably about what you each learned from each other. And it seems like for something that was something of a short musical collaboration, you both got a lot from it.
I love Ramona deeply. What we did together in the 3 years that we worked together is very powerful for me and has remained with me since then, since 1977, 78. She's an incredibly talented artist. We just drifted apart, and I went off and did other bands. But the effect she had on me was very powerful and remains so.
Zoom out a little bit. Could we revisit this concept of the other things that were going on in New York? Were you cognizant of being part of any scene? Who were your contemporaries? If you were a little bit younger than some of the other acts, like who were you looking towards as your generation, if you will?
The thing about that scene is that everyone was completely insular and in their own little bubble and universe. And nobody looked to anybody. Everyone was struggling to be the most singular and unique thing that ever hit the boards. I guess vaguely Suicide. I don't remember looking towards any of the other groups for inspiration or for companionship.
Wow. That strikes me as maybe being a bit of a New York thing in terms of everybody like grinding it out, right? It's to an extent, there's some zero sumness of it.
Grinding it out is a great... You know, being a rock musician is like being a construction worker. It's physically incredibly demanding. You're hiking incredibly heavy equipment at 4:30 in the morning in freezing cold. And you know, it's a rough life. You meet people along the way who you like and some you don't like. I must say that in those days, there was a huge amount of drugs, just drugs and drugs and drugs. And people were just half awake all the time and half sane all the time. People died and there's heroin and, you know, it was kind of nasty. I worked with James Chance a lot and he's not a person you can communicate with. He was an incredible musician and a fascinating personality, but completely in his own world. And that's what that scene was like. Everyone was their own world.
When I was listening to the post Ramona, if you will, a compilation, a few things struck me, actually, even in the singles, the earliest singles. First of all, the sound quality of the recordings lends so much to the timelessness of them. Like those records do not sound like, you know, low budget independent.
Well, thank you very much. Can you be more specific about what you're listening to as far as that goes?
Obviously, the reissued singles that prompted this conversation, but then there's a compilation on Spotify that basically spans, you know, everything from, I guess, I forget, it's a year range in the title.
Well, all of those tracks are made with a major label contract and in major studios. And so was the two singles that this is about. The recording engineer for those records was Harvey J. Goldberg, who's now the audio engineer for Stephen Colbert for the late night. So he was a terrific engineer. We are very lucky to have that because a lot of those bands, their recordings were not representative of how they sounded.
Yeah. In my earlier question around contemporaries, some of the things that I was hearing most closely reminded me of what Anton Fear and Bill Laswell were doing, like Material. Even though your use of the drum machine predates them, it was similar in terms of like this borderline between what became like indie rock, electro, like this fascinating stew of technology and organics and pop and then some experimentalism. It was such a special sort of brew that was going on where people didn't feel adhered to genre.
You know, the original impetus for using the drum machine was so much more mundane than that. The reason we used the drum machine in those days was because it was the way we could fit ourselves and our equipment into a taxi to go to a show. We thought, oh, this is great. We don't have a drummer. We don't need a van. We don't need to pay anyone to drive us to a show. We have an 8-inch box that'll be our drums. And that was it. That was the reason. There was no other reason.
Again, New York is the mother of invention.
It put out a beat. It forced us to play very precisely, which was a good thing because it's basically a metronome. But that was the reason. There was no artistic impetus or deep thought behind it whatsoever.
Yeah. It's interesting, too. You talk about the sort of precision and the metronomic nature of it. It opens up the possibility of being played in clubs, right? Like it becomes sort of dance music, DJ music, whether that was in your mind or not, just that application of the technology opens up that world for you.
Absolutely did. Our very first recordings with Ramona, before the ones that you heard, were very rhythm box, and they immediately went onto the jukebox in Max's Kansas City, and people played them a lot. And I think that's one of the reasons. They were very clear and precise and enjoyable recordings.
If you had initially gotten into this project way back when, not thinking about it in terms of sort of ambition or as becoming the thing, what shifted for you? Was it you just responded to the reaction you were getting and said, hey, there's something here, let's fan the smoke? Or like, how did Comatines become something that took over your creative life for a while?
This is after Ramona left and my brother was in the group and we were playing all the little clubs and we began to get attention. Finally, a producer in France offered us a record contract. And we thought, okay. And the budget for this record was $3,000. We made this record and we went to France and we had a huge hit. And then we had a lot of attention from major labels from that. And we had no idea. We did not plan this. We just went with the tide of what was happening. We were getting a lot of attention and we went for it. All of a sudden we had a manager and it was very strange because we thought of ourselves as this little homebrew operation and it turned into something much bigger than we ever imagined.
We'll be back with more Spotlight On right after this break. Did you know that Spotlight On is completely self-funded by the team that produces it? We're looking for ways to keep the podcast self-sufficient without sacrificing the listener experience or the integrity of the show. The best way we could think of was to ask for the support of our listeners. Please consider making a donation to help cover our annual operating expenses. Go to spotlightonpodcast.com and click the word donate. If you can, please do. And if you cannot, please continue to enjoy the show. We're happy to have you as a listener. Thanks. And now, back to Spotlight On.
Do you know the story of how you came to get attention from the label in France? I just, you know, just thinking about what a different time it was. What was the media or what was the method of which he would have found you?
It's a very strange story because it's this guy was living, he was a Frenchman living in New York, and he was perusing the clubs. He was a young guy, he was early 20s, and he wanted to start a record label. So he was perusing the New York scene. He'd come from Paris. He saw us and liked us, and he asked, for some reason, he got Ramona's number, and he called her, and he said, I like this group called the Comatines. Do you know how to get in touch with them? And she was of two minds about whether to connect us with him, but she did, and that's how it happened. As a matter of fact, the day before he called me, we had broken up the band. We thought, this is too hard, and why are we doing this? And it's depressing, and we were playing for six people at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we thought, okay, let's knock it on the head. That's it. And the next day, this guy called me and he said, I'd like to make a record with you. We said, good, let's do it. A tiny little budget. It was an 8-track record. People are still listening to it.
Did you know the music had its own life, or was that like reintroduced? Like, what's been your relationship with sort of the legacy of Comatines? Were you aware?
Because I was such an admirer of the old songwriters and stuff, the first thing I did, the first time I ever got a song on vinyl, I joined ASCAP. I thought that was the big badge of legitimacy was being an ASCAP. So in that sense, I was very conscious of the biz. I was always the one that once we started rolling, I was always the one that watched what we were doing, watched our business, watched it. I'm kind of an archivist kind of person, and it's me that has kept the legacy going. Like when Ramona came out of nowhere, we hadn't talked in 20 years, to want to do this new release. I had all the tapes from 1978, 79. Yeah, I'm very aware of legacy, and it's my life's work. I treasure it. I treasure all that stuff and all the people that I worked with, and I treasure my relationship with Ramona, too.
Is Comatines an existing concern? Is there a universe in which there's more music from that lineup or performance, or like what happens now?
Well, Ramona is not in condition now to play. Mm. My brother passed away in 1987. So I am still in contact with Lynn, who's another member of the group. And after my brother passed away, I began to write. I went into the background and wrote songs for other artists. I became a professional songwriter. So my music has been out there. It's just not me doing it, but there's a lot of it out there. And I still continue to do that. We've never discussed continuing Comatine per se. This is now a legacy project. You're making it so damn hard. It could have been so darn good. You take a doggone far. Oh, I make the way I wish you should.
You mentioned being the archivist, and it's really no joke. Like the website that you've built, like for even someone who's a student or a scholar of that era in New York, there's several strands that could be pulled on in which the Comatine story is important or fits. Just from a resource point of view, like all of the media, it's just quite a fascinating monument to this work and this time. And to have had the impulse and the inclination to sort of be that person, are you more generally like, are you a pack rat? Are you a, like, what is it in mixed personality that
I'm certainly a pack rat when it comes to recordings and work and photographs. And a lot of the people that I knew during those days were in no mental shape to preserve what they did. The whole thing just got washed away when they disappeared. All of what they did disappeared. I was never like that. I have every recording I've ever made and thousands of photographs, and I am always ready to be able to put out this kind of legacy project. And I like that. I think that's great. Yeah. I don't know what anyone's going to do with all that nonsense when I leave this mortal coil, but it's been very useful for me.
I think it needs to go to the public library in New York. That's just my opinion.
I would do that in a shot. Library of Congress, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it's hard to say this about New York, but I think you'll understand the sentiment I'm getting at, which is these micro scenes from around the country at a time when music was still so regionalized, and there's so much work being done with reissue labels and people who have gone out there and found private pressings or just these music scenes that existed in American cities or different regions.
Yeah.
It's such a fascinating and important part of the sort of post-war fabric in this country.
What's interesting about it is that all this is pre-internet, so that you really had regional artistic scenes. Now it's homogenized because everything that everyone does is instantly disseminated to the entire world. I think that flattens out the relief in which various scenes are shown. I'm glad that we worked before the internet. I like the internet app for distribution of stuff, but I'm glad that we were creative in the pre-internet era.
Yeah.
Because I think the internet sucks, chews up and spits out people's creativity at a rate that's too high.
It's belied by the fact that we call creative output content.
Exactly.
I hate that word. Yeah.
I hate that word. I really do.
I don't know an artist that's ever really made content any more than I know a fan who's consumed content. I've never thought, oh, I'm going to go down to the club tonight and consume me some content.
It's just horrible, you know. I also don't like the expression dropped. They dropped the new episode. They dropped the new album. You know, it makes it sound like garbage. Language counts.
I go on that rant a lot. There's a lot of business-to-business terms or industry jargon that we've let become consumer-facing that really devalues a lot of what we as a sort of culture industry do. Right. Merchandise is another one. Like, merchandise? You really want your fans to buy merchandise? Fans buy collectibles. They buy memorabilia. They buy souvenirs. That's value.
Because it means something emotionally to them. Yes.
Yeah. Merchandise is like what's sitting in a warehouse waiting to be discounted.
Well, you know, now with AI, who the hell knows what? I don't even know what to say about AI and its potential to wreck the artistic landscape. But I don't know. Maybe it's a good thing. What do you think about that?
I think of myself as having grown up as sort of like the first generation that had computers in the home. I'm in my early 50s. I was always into technology. I studied computer science for a short time. Never practiced in that discipline, but entertainment and technology have been my career path. And for a long time, I was like a techno-optimist or a techno-utopian. But I find it increasingly difficult to look back at, especially over the last like 20 years or so, the real corporatization of the internet and feel excited about technology and social media and what that's done to our the sort of relationships, even between families. And
absolutely.
I try not to demonize technology because I do believe it's how people use it that matters.
Well, it's just a delivery system, really, isn't it? Just a delivery system, or it should be just a delivery system.
Yeah, but I also don't know if I believe anymore that the technology doesn't have its own point of view. And I don't mean that from a sentience perspective, but just that you have to have a lot of faith in the institutions that have proven to fail us repeatedly, that any new game-changing technology is going to just be used beneficially. I don't know. I don't like hearing myself speak so cynically about it, but I have a hard time imagining. Essentially, what it boils down to is our ability to create and deploy technology moves faster than our ability to even stop and think about potential implications. We don't model out the implications at all.
No question.
And then we live with them.
You know what I don't like? I don't like the cloud. I don't use the cloud. I don't like the concept of the cloud, of some faceless corporation with a server somewhere which holds all my stuff. And I don't think it's necessary to use the cloud.
It's interesting. My son is 19 and he's in art school and he has a attachable hard drive. He's like, I don't want my stuff in the cloud. And that gives me some hope because I see people of his generation that are turning their backs on some of the convenience they wanted. They don't value the convenience. They value the sort of spark, the soul of it.
Right.
That gives me optimism.
So when you were younger, were you a club goer?
I was always a rock guy. It was later in life that I got into more interesting music.
Where did you grow up?
I was raised outside of New Haven, Connecticut. And then I moved to New York in the mid-90s and was there for about 20 years. Now I'm just outside of Seattle. But it was, so if you mean clubs, not dance clubs, like rock clubs, jazz clubs. When I moved to New York, like, you know, any of the remnants of your era, right? Like the Kitchen, the Knitting Factory, those were all places I knew enough to go seek out.
Did you go to CBGB's at least once?
Yeah. When I first moved to New York, I lived on East 11th between 1st and 2nd. I very intentionally went. I made that pilgrimage, you know, as like a fan of the Beats and that era of music. And even like the loft jazz scene was something that was resonant in my head. So like,
oh, yeah.
Not a lot of it was left, obviously, by the time I got there. But just to walk those same streets meant a lot.
You can't imagine what a mess New York was in 1977. I mean, those neighborhoods were basically like Beirut. They were completely bombed out, burned out, and we were proud of it. We loved walking those streets because there was no pressure on you to be anything. You abandoned cars and stoops and nobody bothered you. You know, it was a little dangerous, but still it was an amazing environment for artistic creation.
Yeah.
Really amazing.
It's funny now, if you take somebody, you say you stroll through Tompkins Square Park, you can't even paint the picture. Like you literally have to watch old film footage or maybe look at photographs to get a sense of like that place was like, not a place you wanted to go hang out with the kids on a Sunday afternoon.
Absolutely not. But we thought we were the outcasts and This was our place. Midtown was where we never went. We were proud of not going above 14th Street. That was our thing.
I held that ethos for a while as well. And it's to hear someone who lived it. Well, I was going to say the first time around, but you know, that's the funny thing about New York is like everybody has their New York. I'd like to think that there's still people that they have their New York, and it's different than the New York I had from the one you had, from the one that maybe Allen Ginsberg had or whatever, but it's their New York. And it's an important place for that.
Right. I grew up in the Upper West Side of New York, and in the late 60s, early 70s, that was an incredible artistic crucible. Isaac Benjamin Singer was living down the street, and the whole place was vibrating with artistic endeavor in a different way, but just as powerful as downtown.
You don't mind me asking, I'm curious about your family history and the Jaffees. And were you connected to that part of your history growing up?
Oh, yeah, sure. Sam was the brother of my father's mother. He was my great uncle. So my grandmother's brother. I didn't see him very often because I lived in New York and he lived in Hollywood. I have some beautiful letters from him. He was another person in his own world. He was a movie star and the universe revolved around Sam. But I'm very proud of being connected. He was an extraordinary person. He wasn't just a great actor. He was a mathematician. He was a composer. And his friends like Zero Mostel, I have great Zero stories, and his son Tobias is a close friend of mine. All these people were I just took them for granted, but they were really magical, a magical bunch.
I think one of the reasons I find it so interesting is there's a combination of the era, which is just such a fascinating time in sort of New York and American history, but also the Jewish artistic and intellectual thing and how
the zeitgeist,
milieu or whatever, with yeah. and how important that is and has been really on so many facets of American culture that don't really get talked about. For a long time I was fascinated by the Catskills and the impact on American comedy and early television, and just you can't disentangle the story of the Eastern European migration to the East Coast of America from really so much of our culture and post-war intellectual tradition.
No question. I mean, Zero is a big part of that, the whole Catskill thing. And then Zero got blacklisted, and so did Sam get blacklisted. I have letters about Sam's blacklist, and that was a torturous thing for him. I don't know if you saw the movie The Front with Woody Allen.
No.
You should see that. It's about the blacklist, and it stars Woody Allen and Zero Mostel. And it's a terrific movie about the blacklist and the effect it had on the Jewish artistic community.
What are you up to next?
I'm really pleased at doing all these interviews about this record. I never thought these songs would see the light of day in any sense. This great guy, Jim Reynolds, who runs the record company that put this out, he's one of these soldiers of the scene who digs up these kind of things and puts them out. And I'm very pleased to be doing this right now. I'll continue to write music. Maybe we'll get some more Comatine stuff out. Well, I don't know how to configure that right now, but it seems it could be fun to do that.
What remains to come out, or is this about repositioning the existing catalog, or do you have things in your
There is other stuff that could come out, yeah. And I have those tapes.
But of course. Well, Nick, thank you for making time. And if it's not too much to ask, please give my best to Ramona.
I will. Thank you, Lawrence.
Thank you so much, Nick Dembling. And as always, thank you for listening to Spotlight On, a production of 23 Media Ventures. I'm your host and executive producer, Lawrence Puryear. We're produced and edited by Michael Donaldson, with theme music by Q-Burn's Abstract Message. If you'd like to support our work, please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts, or visit us online at spotlightonpodcast.com. There you will find our free episode archive, weekly postings on our official blog, ways to support us, and a ton more. Thanks for listening. Be safe. Stay in touch.